Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's HandyLink. You're listening to HandyLink on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Welcome to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. I'm your host, Cam Wells. This first interview contains mature subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
In this segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Gabriel Perriot from Humanity and Inclusion Canada. So tell me a little bit about Humanity and Inclusion.
Sure. So Humanity and Inclusion is an international solidarity organization. So we intervene in situations of poverty and exclusion or conflict and disaster. And we work alongside people with disabilities and vulnerable populations to basically help them meet their basic needs, improve their living conditions, and promote respect for their dignity and fundamental rights. It's in, like, small sentence what we do.
So, what are some of the biggest challenges you found internationally for people with disabilities?
Basically, people with disabilities, they're 15% of the population. So you got to realize that it's about like 1 billion people around the world. So that live with some sort of disability. And most of these people, they live in developing countries. And that's where Humanity and Inclusion intervenes. Because in these countries, some of the health systems, some of the education systems, some of whatever's in place in the cities, whatever, it's not adapted for these populations. So our job basically is just to intervene and just to make sure that these people are not left behind. You're talking about challenges. I think we encounter the most challenges in a situation of a disaster or conflict, because these situations disrupt like the normal course of things. And when there's a hurricane, for example, most of the time it's people with disability that are left behind because they're just not able to access the humanitarian aid that's being made available by other organizations.
So in what areas do you mostly operate?
We operate in like pretty much a lot of areas. We implement inclusive projects, and that's like it can be education projects, it can be socio-economical projects like in the workplace. But we also do give rehabilitation services. So historically, our organization was born to help amputees, like refugees with amputation, and provide them with prostheses or crutches. So still today, we do rehabilitation services, but we also intervene in the healthcare systems. Like I said, we intervene in emergencies, and we do a lot of advocacy work towards explosive weapons. So explosive weapons, they can be landmines, bass, or explosive weapon in populated area.
So,
cells and stuff.
So what sort of work do you do to deal with the effect of explosives?
With explosives, well, I'm happy you asked that question because it's one of our major fights, and it's a fight that's been at the core of our organization since the beginning. So, like I said, humanity and inclusion in 82 was born because we were trying to help those refugees that were victims of landmines, and provide them with crutches, provide them with prosthesis, and help them with rehab services. But then it contributed our work towards our advocacy work against landmines. And in 97, with other partner NGOs, we were able to come up with the Ottawa Treaty, which made it impossible for countries who signed the declaration to use, to sell, or to exchange the landmines. And then after that, we went onto a fight towards explosive weapons in populated areas. It's a fight that's still going on. And we're hoping pretty much at the end of the year or beginning of next year to have a declaration signed in Dublin to make it impossible for states to use explosive weapons in populated areas, so in cities, in regions where civil population live, perhaps in conflict zones such as in Syria and Yemen and so on.
So how do you go about reaching out to refugee populations in regards to this work?
Regarding our fighting against explosive weapons?
Yes, and that you are available to provide some supports.
So basically, when we're dealing with refugees, it's always it's a difficult situation because most of the refugees or migrants are on the move. They're not necessarily at home. So basically, we're entering in refugee camps or in migrant camps. And regarding explosive weapons, there are two types of intervention we can think of. We go towards the refugees that have been victims of landmines. And we, like I said, help them with rehab services. We try to make their injury less impactful on the long term by providing them prosthesis or crutches. And but the other important work is education, because there are a lot of children in those refugee camps. There are a lot of people that are not aware of the dangers that explosive weapons make. And we think of explosive weapons like an immediate danger, like the missile comes and it explodes and that's it. But we tend to forget that some of the explosives don't explode on impact and are buried underground. So our education work is to tell those children, tell those people in camps to be aware of danger zones and take the necessary measure not to get injured by those weapons on the long run.
So, in your time with Humanity and Inclusion, has there been any success moment that stands out for you?
And personally, well, since I've been at Humanity and Inclusion, or successes for the whole organization?
A little of both.
I think one of the biggest success for Humanity and Inclusion, and back then it was named Handicap International, is certainly the fight of the organization against landmines and the big success we had with the Ottawa Treaty, which was actually signed in Ottawa in Canada, and which banned landmines, and more than 150 countries have signed the declaration. So it was really a big success for us. Personally, I've been I visited the refugee camps in Bangladesh. Actually, we call them displaced camps because they're not actually considered as refugees. And there were allegedly some victims of the landmines inside these camps. And I was just super proud personally to see the help that was provided to people that have been affected by the crisis, or actually didn't meet personally like people that have been victim of landmines, but I was just super proud of the help that was provided to the most vulnerable groups inside this displaced camp.
So you were telling me that your work has been honored for kind of changing the landscape of things.
Yeah, so again, regarding our fight against landmines, we were super proud that it led to the Ottawa Treaty, which was signed in Ottawa, Canada. And our organization was co-recipient of the 97 Nobel Peace Prize for its fight against this terrible weapon.
Like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure thing.
In this segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Sean Wiltshire, who will be giving us an update on the disability employment situation in the middle of the pandemic. So in the past few weeks, with the ongoing COVID situation, how has disabilities employment been affected?
Well, I think it's been pretty much, we could say, it's been decimated. There has absolutely been thousands of people lose their jobs who have disabilities across the country. In my own organization, we saw about 55% of people laid off. We saw several other people who had to go into isolation because they were in contact with somebody at their workplace. Across the country, we're hearing similar stories from all of the organizations that we partner with. We're seeing the concern will be, how do we reintegrate back into the workforce as we come out of COVID-19? One positive has been many things that people said could not be done from home or could not be done remotely are now being done very easily. So it does give us some challenges on how we integrate people and make sure that we are included in the recovery. But there's also that opportunity there that we see of how do we ensure that the ability to work from home remotely are given consideration across the board, not only for folks with disabilities. So I think as we go forward, that will be a positive we will try and focus on and give the opportunity for people to not only regain employment, but for some folks, first opportunity, being able to work from home will be a great opportunity to enter the workforce.
So with that being said, and the discovery that people can, in fact, do more work from home, do you think it might lead to some advancement for these people with disabilities? The recognition that they can actually do more than has been previously given to them.
Yes, absolutely. It's that sort of, we don't know what we don't know. And up until this point, there was so much stuff in our society that both government and community said, and employers said, couldn't be done at home. Now that we've been put in this situation, we've recognized that with a few adaptations, and that's for everybody, you know, good internet, better software, we are able to do productivity from home. We are able to manage workspaces from home. And as we move forward, this is an opportunity for us to really focus on the fact that the skills that people have really don't impact where they do their work. They have the skill.
So, have you heard any success cases about someone being able to adapt and work from home?
Well, what we're seeing right now is a lot of people have been laid off. We have a number of people that continue to work, but it's in the work environment. We've only had three people who have been looking to see, are they going to be able to adapt to work from home? Most of the folks we work with work in service and highly industrialized industries where they're on a work site to do the job. So we're all also now focusing on some new folks, some folks who are on the spectrum who have been looking for new work, and we're now hoping that this may be a new trajectory of people to be able to work from home who may be able to take on work that previously people didn't think was capable of being done. I think that this pandemic has exposed two things that society has to address as we move forward. One is the treatment of individuals with disabilities. Not only did we hear in the media about the unemployment rate, but we constantly had to hear about what were the regulations around ventilators for people who had disabilities, the outbreaks of COVID-19 in support homes that didn't have proper protective equipment. So there's a reckoning coming after this about how we both invest our money into preventative measures and to what is a real support. I think a couple of things you'll see is that you won't see seniors' homes with four people living in a room anymore. You won't see subservient wages for a lot of the support roles that people take on in the community. We are now understanding, as we've seen everywhere, it's not the billionaires who saved us, it's the people who work at those supermarkets and continue that supply chain that has kept society going during this pandemic. And that includes folks with disabilities. I mean, we have a number of people who work at supermarkets and work in food delivery, who work in industrialized processes that support the food chain. They're responsible. They're the people who are making it possible for you to go to your supermarket. It isn't the billionaires and the sports stars and the rock stars. It's that person with Down syndrome. It's that person with mental health concerns. They're working their job and they're doing their best to support you. And a recognition, I think, of who's important in the community and what roles people play and how we value them. It's great to see people getting a premium during this time in the supermarket industry, food service, but that will have to continue. Those are things we need to see improve.
So what message would you send to the community about keeping things going along these lines to improve?
I think self-advocacy, that constantly acknowledging that we've known this all along. We are able to do this. We manage our lives. We can manage our work. And demonstrated that what everybody thought we couldn't do, we've done. And what everybody thought we couldn't connect with, we've connected. I think the really important thing here is that we continue to have these conversations that say to people, where do you find the value in the people in your society? And that's also in work. So when we say to people, where do we include people? Now we can say it doesn't matter if you work at home, because lots of people are going to work at home. The challenge here is how do we ensure that employers see that as valuable?
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this.
Anytime, Cameron. It's always a great chat with you.
HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
The Disability Studies Students Association is a small and tight-knit community of people who are passionate about and committed to representing and supporting disability studies students at the University of Windsor. The DSSA holds events on campus and in the community, like the annual Down Syndrome Day Walk, to raise funds for supporting organizations. If you would like to get involved or learn more, you can contact the Disability Studies Student Association directly at dssa@uwindsor.ca.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from Gabriel Perio from Humanity and Inclusion and from Sean Wiltshire from Avalon Employment. In the next segment of our show, we'll hear from Vera Pina from the Zajac Ranch.
So tell me a little bit about your work at the ranch.
Okay, so we are a summer camp for children with higher needs. And this could be anything from mental disabilities to physical disabilities. We cater to about 80 different diagnoses every year. And I'm the camp director. So my job is to manage our summer camps and also the school groups and community groups that come in the fall and in the spring. And we're a nonprofit. So those schools and those community groups, they fund our summer programs for the campers.
So what sorts of disabilities do you most commonly see in your camps?
What's the what? Sorry, I missed the first bit.
Okay. What types of conditions do you most commonly see among the campers?
Yeah, so the most common ones would probably be the Down syndrome and autism. So we actually have two sessions out of the summer that are specific to kids with autism. And then in our mixed diagnosis sessions, which are all the others, then I'd say, yeah, one of the most common diagnoses would be Down syndrome. And then you've got a lot of syndromes. Some are really rare. Some are more common. It varies.
So can you tell me a little bit about the camps themselves? What sorts of activities and programs are available?
Mm-hmm. So I would say we're a typical camp for atypical kids, right? So the activities that we offer are the same activities you would find in any traditional summer camp in North America. So we've got waterfront activities like canoeing and kayaking and swimming. We've got an indoor pool, arts and crafts, performing arts, riding, horse riding, high ropes, low ropes. Yeah, that's about it. And then in addition to those activities, we have a bunch of other, you know, traditional camp activities like campfires and talent shows and stuff like that.
So are there any challenges in setting these programs up and putting this all together?
Are there any challenges in putting it together? Not particularly. I'd say that perhaps having a... It's important that in each activity area, you can cater to a wide range of abilities, right? So, for example, if you're doing arts and crafts and it's an art project, in the same class, in the same group, our groups are about eight to 10 kids each. You could have a kid that has, you know, again, like I said, you could have autism or some problem with mental development, but physically they can execute the, you know, like they can paint really well, or, you know, or they have no problem, like with they can execute that really well. And you may have kids who have some motor problems, so they can't do it at all. So it's important to be able in every activity to cater to a wide range of abilities. Whereas I'd say that in traditional camps, because you usually split the kids by age group, you know, when you get a group of typical 7-year-olds or 14-year-olds, they all have very similar abilities. And so I'd say that's the biggest challenge, but that's something that we address during staff training. So our the activity heads for each activity, they know to plan for that.
So in your time doing this work, what's been the greatest success story you've witnessed?
I don't know if I have one in particular. We have a really high return rate for our campers, right? I'd say that about 85 to 90% of our campers, they're returners, and they've been coming for a really long time. In fact, like in our young adult sessions, we have campers who've been coming to camp for the past 10, 12, 15 years, so way longer than I've been here. And that's always really nice to see, that kids feel like this is home away from home. And yeah, obviously, you know, they feel at home here. You've got kids who need more time, who like the first summer or second summer, they're still getting to know everything and everyone. And you have kids who, you know, they know every corner of camp, and that's really great. It's great to see the ones exploring for the first time and the ones who consider this home.
So you mentioned earlier about the staff training. Can you tell me a little bit about what goes into that?
Mm-hmm. So our staff training is 2 weeks long, and we've got a lot of external speakers. So usually we have a neurosurgeon that comes and tells our staff about different seizures. For example, when you asked me before about, some of the most common diagnoses, I actually forgot to mention epilepsy. We have a lot of kids who have seizures. And so that's one of the things that we do. And they're shown videos of different types of seizures, for example. So those who've never seen it or experienced it, so that they know exactly what it looks like and what to do. We have someone coming to talk about Down syndrome, again, because as I mentioned, it's such a prevalent diagnosis here that we felt it was important. And this, everyone's met kids with Down syndrome, but just to explain to them about the little particularities of it. What else do we have? So there's a bunch of external speakers. There's a part of staff training that has to do with protocols and procedures. So like the firemen, for example, they come to just for the practicality of like, what would you do in case of a fire at this particular camp, in these settings, and to show people how to use fire extinguishers and all that stuff. So that's another component of it. So external speakers, the protocols, and then a lot of just social behavior, how to deal with a kid who refuses to go to an activity or is having a tantrum or wants to go home, like how to deal with those different scenarios, like homesick kids. We obviously have a lot of protocols in place for all that stuff too. And there's a lot of team bonding as well. So it's a really tough job for the counselors. It's obviously really rewarding, but it's tough. So it's really important to us that the team gels well and that everyone's on the same page and understand what their roles are, but that they're also willing to help each other and step out of their comfort zone to help other counselors. And so, yeah, I'd say it's a mix of those four things.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
My friends, earlier in the show, we heard about the efforts to prevent use of landmines and explosive weapons. Now, this struck me as an amazing thing. Such weapons are designed to have an effect that can and will cause disabilities. The fact is, it's just not necessary. We as a people can do better. And I am so pleased to hear that Humanity and Inclusion's work is going to try to extend this. For in times like these, we're looking for normal life. We're looking for the best of what's available. Something like that can really, really readjust what a person's best opportunities would be. In places where such things do still exist, taking away an opportunity when there are so few and far between is not a thing we can allow to happen. We as a people should be working together, building a better future, creating opportunities not just for people with disabilities, but for everyone in society. How is it that we can come together so easily in some ways, rally around common needs, and then just overlook something because it's outside our immediate field of view? I mean, it's work like this to change all that I am very honored to have as a part of this work. For it's true, people with disabilities, they are everywhere in this world. And if it's happening to one of us, that's too many. And if it's happening to one, it's happening to others. And when we all come together, pool our resources, pool our ideas, and yes, even communicate with our leaders to tell them we can do better, and opportunities should not be destroyed nor taken away. That is when we reach our best. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me You've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.